Well, please open your Bibles to Psalms 23. Psalms 23. We've spent a considerable amount of time on this psalm, and I don't deliberately mean to belabor the point, and I know the point is we need to cover some amount of material, but we need to cover it, I think, in a thorough way so that we remember the lessons, not just the words of the psalm. All right, in the 23rd psalm, first let me thank Richard for teaching the class for the last two Sundays and for your participation in that. I must admit and confess to you, I've not had the time since I got back to go back and listen. In fact, I've not even checked to see if it's online. It is, but I apologize for that. It's been a real busy time since I got home, as some of you are aware. And we will pursue in our study this morning with simply the place that Richard told me to start, or asked me to start. But by way of getting into the text, the quotation that is on the board is from the 1911 King James, 1611 King James translation. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. And then verse 6, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, I understand that Richard talked with you about the providence of the provisions of God, the preparation of the table, and the anointing of one's head with oil, and quite a little bit of background information on where some of that comes from. So I want to look in our study this evening, or this morning, with this next expression, my cup runneth over. Now I know, and you do too, that often in our studies when we think about a cup that is overflowing, passage that typically comes to my mind to illustrate the point is the Apostle Paul's writing to the church in Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 regarding the blessings that are afforded through the resurrection of Jesus. And in that chapter, he spends a great deal of time establishing that Jesus was indeed raised from the dead. Now, the point of that is to establish the hope that these Christians have. And as he comes to the last verse of that chapter, the writer says, wherefore, my beloved brethren, be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not vain in the Lord. Now, when we look at this passage, we see what our work is to do. But by way of contrast, this passage that we have on the board illustrates what God has done for us. My cup runs over. Now, the psalmist he writes repeated themes about the things that God has done and the beseeching that we do of God. And so to study the psalms verse by verse, as we've discussed in the introductory material, presents all kinds of difficulties for us in that respect. But to catalog them and group them together, we see some benefit in our study. And as we look at this psalm, it also elaborates Psalms 36, verse 8, they shall be abundantly satisfied with the fatness of thy house, and thou wilt make them drink of the river of thy pleasures. Here again shows simply the abundance of the blessings that God bestows upon those who serve him. So we also must rejoice in that our cup runs over. The eunuch, as you recall, in Acts chapter 8, had been to the city of Jerusalem in order to worship. He had put great effort as a what appears to be a proselyte Jew to go to the city of Jerusalem and to worship as he had traveled over 1,000 miles one way in a chariot. But as Philip is speaking with him in Acts chapter 8, he teaches him about Jesus. And the eunuch desires to be baptized, and Philip baptized him, and he went on his way rejoicing. Now, question, did the eunuch understand the gravity of what Philip had told him about who Jesus is and what the will of Jesus is for him and how that God had made provision to forgive him of his sin? And did he understand the gravity of what forgiveness is all about? And I think sometimes, brethren, that we become so oriented in learning the academics that we forget the application of just how big it is of what God has done for us and how that our cup runs over with the blessings that God has afforded us through the sacrifice of his son. Same thing with the jailer. Now, quite a contrast between these two men, just to illustrate the point. The eunuch evidently is a religious man. The jailer is not, far from it. He is a heathen man in Acts chapter 16. And we know that he's charged with keeping Paul and Silas most securely. And we know also that upon being taught the word of the Lord, he desires to be baptized. He and all his house did so immediately. Now, I think the point I want us to see is this eunuch understands the history of the Jews and what God had planned through the coming of the seed of Abraham. But this jailer, he has it all to learn. He doesn't know anything about it. But he learned enough that night to appreciate what God had done for him to obey the gospel the same hour of the night. Now, what effect does that have on you? What effect does it have on me? The psalmist said, my cup runs over. Is it one thing to simply have an academic appreciation of it and another thing to understand what God has done for us? Well, the answer to that's yes. We can learn the academics, but to emotionally be stirred by that. And I think sometimes we miss that point. The eunuch went on his way rejoicing. The jailer had occasion to rejoice, he and his whole house. And you read in Acts 2 concerning those Jews that had been indicted with the crucifixion of the Lord. They partook of their food with gladness and singleness of heart. So this element of my cup runs over and the emotional impact that that has upon one who understands the gravity of the blessings God has afforded us, we need to appreciate that. And it should be reflected in the way that we conduct ourselves. Now, I don't like, sometimes I know we become guilty of being critical of the ooey gooey drip from the ceiling kind of feely stuff, and rightly so, because blessings that are afforded us in Christ is not just prompted from ooey gooey feely drip from the ceiling kind of emotion, but when we eliminate the emotion from it, then we've just eliminated the joy of the blessings that God gives us. And I don't understand that. I was talking with some folks in these two meetings I held that sometimes when I'm preaching on these things, I tend to get a little bit excited about it. And shouldn't we? I think so. I think there should be some emotion in what we are trying to present to folks. Of course, to present the gospel is not an emotional approach. But if you look at verse 12 of 1 Peter chapter 4, here are Christians that are suffering because of their faith. Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial among you which cometh upon you to prove you as though a strange thing happened to you. But insomuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, rejoice, that at the revelation of his glory also ye may rejoice with exceeding joy. What is it that they are anticipating? They're suffering now, but they're anticipating the coming of the Lord. And when he comes, what will be their attitude about that? Oh, I suffered and I had a hard time in this life and it was just woe is me. No, he said, rejoice with exceeding joy. If ye are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, because the Spirit of glory and the Spirit of God resteth upon you. For let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or a meddler in other men's matters. But if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. Let him glorify God in this name. Now, is there some emotion involved in what Peter has said here? And who better to express it than Peter? We see Paul expressing the same thing in case you're thinking about Paul. But Peter had endured a whole lot because of his faith. And we know that Peter had denied the Lord and all of that. But let's see who we are. Matthew chapter 5, verse 11, Jesus talked about suffering for his name's sake. And they persecuted the prophets that were before you. So you suffer and be glad and rejoice always in the Lord. Paul said to the Philippians, chapter 4, verse 4. And again I say, rejoice. You ever get down? You ever get discouraged? Maybe we need to stop and give some thought to what God's blessed us with. Our cup runs over. There's occasion for joy. There's occasion for gladness. And there's occasion to talk about that with other people. When we understand what the forgiveness of sins, what that really offers to us. No one on earth has more right to rejoice than the people of God. And you see that expressed by David in the 23rd Psalm. Now we might raise the question. All of this joy, all the things that we've been discussing in the 23rd Psalm is contingent upon the very first expression in the very first verse. What is that?
The Lord is my shepherd.
So I shall not want. He's abundantly blessed. The Lord is my shepherd. Here's occasion for us to rejoice. Now this last expression in the 23rd Psalm. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Or the next to the last expression. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Goodness. Well, does everything that happens to you in life, can you define that as being good? Everything that happens to me, it's all good. Lost a child, early age. That's good for me, right? Well, help me with this. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Let's talk about David. What happened to David? Somebody tell me about David. David sinned with Bathsheba, didn't he? Had a child. What happened to the child? He died. What effect that have on David? He's devastated, yeah. He's just devastated. David had a daughter. What was her name?
Tamar.
Tamar. What happened to Tamar? Was raped by her brother. Well, that's not good. David had a son, another brother. What happened to that son? Absalom. Yeah, what happened to Absalom? Oh, yeah, Absalom. But before that, Absalom killed his brother that had raped his sister. He laid a plot that took him about 2 years to unfold. Killed his own brother. That's what he did.
Which is what David should have done to begin with.
Well, yeah, but look at the mess. It's all happening in David's family. What a mess. And then Absalom decided to take the kingdom away from his daddy. Began to have a following and led an army against David's army, against his captain, Joab. David had to flee the city of Jerusalem for the sake of the city of Jerusalem. And people throwing rocks at him. Oh, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. Could we look at all of that happened to David and say, well, that's all good for David? Well, no. But I want us to see some things in this. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. That's contingent upon the Lord is my shepherd. Now let us understand, friends and brethren, that sometimes bad things happen to us as a consequence of our sin. That forgiveness does not remove. But overall, goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. As long as I'm following the shepherd. Now don't we see that? Now look, if you will, at David's remark in Psalm 31. Oh, how great is thy goodness, which thou hast laid up for them that fear thee. Well, had David always feared God? Did he fear God when he was committing fornication with Bathsheba? No. No, he didn't. Now, look at this. Oh, how great is thy goodness, which thou hast laid up for them that fear thee. Now, David's got the facts right, don't he? But he just simply didn't always do it. And he reaped the consequences of it.
So we need to learn that. So God blesses his people with the blessing of his goodness as long as they're following the shepherd. And mercy. Oh, we need mercy. In Psalm 40, David said, withhold not thou thy tender mercies from me, O Jehovah. Let thy loving kindness and thy truth continually preserve me. Did David know he needed the mercy of God? Now, I've used this illustration a bunch of times, and I'm sure that you remember it, about the fellow that, or the young fellow that committed a crime during the days of Napoleon. Remember the illustration? And his mother began to beseech Napoleon on behalf of her son because the penalty for the crime that he had committed was death. And she sought the king for mercy and to spare her son. And the king commented, he doesn't deserve mercy. He deserves to die. And the mother affectionately said, I'm not asking for what he deserves, because if you give him what he deserves, it would not be mercy. She's asking for mercy. Now, what is mercy?
Not getting what you deserve.
Isn't that simple? Okay. So, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. If what? If we're following the shepherd. Isn't that simple? Mercy is an interesting word. God is rich in mercy, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 4. Mercy is a word that's used, according to my concordance, 116 times in the American Standard Translation, which tells us that we really need that. Now, God's goodness is reserved for those who continue in His goodness. Now, in an interesting context, turn with me, if you will, to Romans, the 11th chapter. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with Romans, the 11th chapter in particular, and in general, the theme of the book of Romans. We've asked in our authority study so many times that if you wanted to study some books of the Bible that compare the Old Testament law with the law of Christ, what books would you study? Galatians?
Hebrews
and...
I'm going to go with Romans.
Go with Romans. That's good. Good choice. Go with Romans. Okay. And so in the Roman letter, Paul spends a great deal of time with it. In Romans, the first chapter, he's talking about the sin of the Gentiles. In Romans, the second and third chapter, he's talking about the sins of the Jews and pointing out that the Jews know better than the Gentile because you do exactly the same thing. But then as we come to the 11th chapter, it seems that all these bad things have happened to the Jews to prompt the question, I say then, did God cast off his people? Does the Jew stand a chance because he's a Jew? Well, the answer to that, no, God didn't cast them off. Paul himself said, I am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin, and so forth. So no, God didn't cast off the Jew because he's a Jew. But he saves the Jew in exactly the same way that he saves the Gentile. And then he uses a familiar illustration for us. And if you'll note, beginning in verse 16, he said, and if the first fruit is holy, so is the lump, and if the root is holy, so are the branches. But if some of the branches were broken off, and thou, being a wild olive, was grafted in among them, and didst become partaker with them of the root of the fatness of the olive tree, glory not over the branches, but if thou gloriest, it is not thou that bearest the root, but the root thee. Now, you're familiar with the illustration. He says in verse 19, thou wilt say then, branches were broken off that I might be grafted in. Well, by their unbelief they were broken off, and thou standest by thy faith. Be not high-minded, but fear. For if God spared not the natural branches, neither will he spare thee. Behold then the goodness and severity of God toward them that fell, severity but toward thee. God's goodness, if thou continue in his goodness, otherwise thou also shall be cut off. Now you see the image that is presented. Here you've got an olive tree. We've got a wild olive tree root, okay? And with this olive tree, I'm sorry, we've got an olive tree root that's rooted in the Jews. But we've got the wild olive tree, the Gentiles, grafted in. Now, Donna's dad had an English walnut tree, just to illustrate the point. We see this all the time, don't we? And the English walnut tree was grafted onto a black walnut root. And the reason was the black walnut root was more hardy than the English walnut root. So you graft the English walnut onto the black walnut, and you cut away then what begins to sprig out up here, the black walnut. And so you maintain that which is English walnut, and you have a healthy, big, edible English walnut. You can make an English walnut pie. It tastes kind of like a pecan pie. It's all real good. But this is the illustration that he's using.
You can explain to Juan about the pecan pie that's with walnuts.
Oh, well, you can make a pecan pie with walnuts, and it tastes similar. When you don't have pecans, you use what you got. My mother used oatmeal. It made good pie. So you do what you do. But you see the illustration. Here you've got the Jewish root. You've got the Gentile grafted in. And the Gentile is grafted in because of God's goodness. And the Jew was cut off because of disobedience. And Mr. Gentile over here, he can look at Mr. Jew and brag and boast and say, look at you, you got cut off because you wasn't doing what's right. And I got grafted in. Look at me, how great I am. Oh, but Paul says, you beware. Don't glory in the fact that you're grafted in, because you can be cut off too because of disobedience, just like Mr. Jew over here. So what we want to see then is God's goodness is reserved for those who continue in His goodness. Now that includes Jew or Gentile. Do we see that? But the specific point here is to Mr. Gentile. You've got to maintain your goodness in order to receive God's continued goodness. Isn't that simple? And this is our point here, and this is our point from Psalms 23. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, but it's dependent upon following the shepherd. Everything comes back to that. I think perhaps the greatest illustration that's helpful to me is the prodigal. He understood the goodness of his father, but the goodness of his father was reserved for those who lived there. Isn't that simple? What happened to him when he was way off up in this far country, thinking he was living it up, and then a famine occurred? Now his father's goodness is down here, but what's happening to him up there? He's starving to death. And he reasons and says, well, the servants in my father's house, and not just anybody's servants, but my father's servants, they have bread enough to spare, and I perish here with hunger. So what will I do? I will arise and I will go to my father's house. Where were the blessings? Up here in this far country with a stranger? In somebody else's house? Where were the blessings? They were in his father's house. So I'll rise and I'll go to my father's house. And I'll tell him, I've sinned against you and against heaven. I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of the hired servants. Now see, he doesn't even ask to be restored to his position of son, but he knows where the blessings are, and they're in his father's house. So that's where I'll go. And I'll ask to be made as one of the hired servants. Now we see that, don't we? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The Lord is my shepherd. Goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, as long as I'm following the shepherd. Because that's where the blessings are. All right? The blessings of salvation. Well, they're reserved for those who continue to walk in Him. We've talked recently and just mentioned this morning, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. And the point that Paul is making to them is, I preach to you the gospel, and the gospel will save you if you hold fast to the word which I preached, lest it all be in vain. So, once again, we see this point. And it's just amplified over and over and over. We could cite a lot of passages from the epistles, but I think you see that. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, as long as you're following the shepherd. But what if you stop following the shepherd? Well, it takes it back to John 10, doesn't it? I'm the good shepherd, and I love my sheep, and I lay down my life for my sheep. And my sheep, they hear my voice. And they follow me. Now they'll not perish as long as they hear my voice and follow me. I'll take care of them. And that's what David's expressing in this passage. Isn't that beautiful to see what the relationship is of a shepherd and the sheep? And then he says, I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I wish that it was within my persuasive abilities. I say that a lot. To persuade everybody to see this blessing. I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. You recall Psalm 133, verse 1. Where David said, I was glad when they said unto me, let us go unto the house of the Lord. I was glad. I wish we had the house full this morning to hear this point. You ever get up in the morning and you don't feel good? Maybe you was up a little late on Saturday night. And you just wore smack dab out to a frazzle and you say, I just don't feel like going this morning. Then you have to remind yourself what's on the other end of that trip. Get to be with God's people. David said, I was glad when they said unto me, let us go to the house of the Lord. Betty Jo, I'm going to brag on you in a public way this morning. I've talked to Betty so many times, and I tease her a lot about whether she knows whether she's coming or going, because a lot of the time, you know, Betty lives in California City. She drives a long way to get here. And, of course, you all live a long way, drive a long way to get here. And sometimes Betty's getting off work, working all night. She comes to worship. And sometimes she comes to worship and is going to work. So that's why I tease her, do you know whether you're coming or going this morning? Getting off work or going to work? But she's here. And her presence, just her presence. I can't begin to tell you, Betty, how much that means to me and how much it means to Donna and how much it means to others in this congregation who have expressed themselves. So this idea of, I was glad when they said unto me, let us go into the house of the Lord, is something that sometimes takes a little self-motivating to do, but once you're here, it's kind of worth it, isn't it? And that's the point of it all. But to dwell in the house of the Lord forever. David understood what that meant. That the Lord not only provided blessings here, but that the Lord has promised something eternal. Dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, Abraham, I get amused sometimes. I've studied with people in times gone by who questioned whether or not some of the Old Testament characters like Abraham had any real perception of eternity or any real perception of heaven. And I like to turn to Hebrews chapter 11 just to note what was said about Abraham. Beginning in verse 10, speaking of Abraham, it says, for he looked for a city which hath the foundation, whose builder and maker is God. Now, what was Abraham looking for? How did Abraham live his life from day to day? The text tells us, dwelling in tents, sojourning from place to place. Any of you like to go camping? You ever like to go camping? Time's gone. Well, most of us have in times gone by. And most of us have lived in a tent for a few days, enjoying the scenery around a lake or a stream, fishing or hunting and that kind of thing. Also good. And I'll dare say that by the time about a week or maybe 2 weeks has passed, you're missing your bed. That'd be about right. One night, you're missing your bed. Yeah. Abraham lived in tents as a sojourner. Now, when you go camping and you live in a tent, what is that? Temporary, yes. And when you build a house, you build a house on a foundation. Because, you see, you don't want to have to hook onto that and move every week or two or three, do you? You put it on a foundation because you plan on being there a while. You're putting down roots. Now, that's called a trailer. Well, maybe so. But what we note is that Abraham looked for a city that had foundation, whose builder and maker is God. Now let's ask the question, did Abraham have any kind of understanding about heaven? Yeah, I think he did. Yeah, he had a good understanding about heaven. About a place that was permanent. Now you'll notice in verse 16, the thought continues, but now they desire a better country that is a heavenly. Did Abraham understand something about heaven? Sure he did. Did he want to go there? Absolutely he did. And you'll notice in verse 16 it says, wherefore God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. So what Abraham anticipated, a city that has foundation, he anticipated going to the place God prepared. Wasn't that simple? Yeah, he had an understanding about heaven. What God had made known about that. He had the kind of faith that David is expressing here. Job reflected that. His question was, if a man dies, shall he live again? Did Job know the answer to that? Well, yeah. If a man die, yes, he shall live again. You'll notice in chapter 19, Job said that when he died, I will live with God apart from this body. Job knew that. Now, that's what David's saying. I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, there's another passage that David wrote about in Psalm 27. Look, if you will, beginning in verse 1. Jehovah is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Jehovah is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? Then evildoers came upon me to eat up my flesh, even mine adversaries and my foes. They stumbled and fell. Though the host should encamp against me, my heart shall not fail. Though war should rise against me, even then will I be confident. One thing have I asked of Jehovah, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of Jehovah all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of Jehovah. Now what's that do for you? It's similar to what he said in Psalm 23, isn't it? Dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Well, godliness is not only has the promise of the life that now is, but as Paul's writing to Timothy, of that which is to come. And our understanding of that should be made clear from the 23rd Psalm. We will have a new body. What will it look like?
We don't
know. I don't know. What will it be like? Be like Him. Well, I don't know what it'll look like, but we know what He is will be like Him. Paul said, my citizenship is in heaven. And we've seen that before, as we've read in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. In 1 Corinthians chapter 5, 4 and 5, the latter part of that, if you've not memorized that, you ought to commit that to memory. Because Paul said, I look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are unseen. For the things which are seen, what happens to them? They'll perish. But the things which are not seen, what happens to them? Well, bottom line, they won't perish. And Paul said, for we know that if this tabernacle be destroyed, we have a house built by God, eternal, in the heavens. And that's what he anticipated. That's what he yearned for, as you read the next several verses of 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Now that's what David is expressing here. Do you have that same kind of confidence that David expressed? The same kind of confidence that the Apostle Paul expressed? That the Apostle Peter expressed? That this hope is reserved in heaven for you? Won't fade away. It's undefiled. Reserved there for you. The pursuit of enemies can last only for a while. But then the goodness and the mercy of God will prevail. And enemies will be no more. You ever get tired of fighting the battles? Yeah. Well, to anticipate a place where there won't be any more battles. Won't be any more battles. This writer is describing that. I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I'd suggest to you that that's fairly comforting. Should be. And so that's why we try to memorize the 23rd Psalm. Can you speak with the faith, the conviction, the confidence, the assurance of David? Well, you see, it's all contingent upon that first expression. The Lord is my shepherd. And therefore, he said, I shall not want. Now, if you've not started that, then it's time to get started, isn't it? And if you know somebody that doesn't recognize the Lord as the only shepherd, then maybe we need to have that conversation, isn't it? All right. Any questions or comments? We've, as we said, spent a good bit of time on the 23rd Psalm, but isn't there a lot of information there? Just a lot of goodies that I hope will build our faith to the strength that David had. Well, the next thing that I want to talk with you about, This kind of moves a little bit as it discusses more of the Psalms of guidance. And we're not taking these necessarily in any kind of logical order. But I wanted to pick this one to study with you from Psalms 15. Now, let's just read the psalm. Randy's not here, but if you'll tolerate me, I'll try to read it. And I think you'll see just a very vivid picture that the psalmist draws. It says, Jehovah, who shall sojourn in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? Now, isn't that the point that was made in the latter part of the 23rd Psalm? I'll dwell in the house of the Lord. Now, he's asking the question, who's going to do that? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? And then he tells us, verse 2, he that walketh uprightly and worketh righteousness and speaketh truth in his heart, he that slandereth not with his tongue, nor doeth evil to his friend, nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbor, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honoreth them that fear Jehovah, he that sweareth by his own hurt and changeth not, he that putteth not out his money to interest, nor taketh reward against the innocent, he that doeth these things shall never be moved. Now, I want to suggest to you, just as we look at Psalm 23, that Psalm 15, man, it's rich. It's just got a lot of good information that I think will be helpful to us, because he's describing a contrast between the righteous person and the wicked person. And don't we need to know that? That contrast is seen a lot of times in Scripture. For example, when you turn to the text of Galatians chapter 5, in this familiar territory, when you talk about the lust of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, don't you see opposing contrast there? When you look at Ephesians chapter 4 and 5, and you see how they used to walk and how they are to walk now, do you see opposing contrast? When you look in Colossians 3, beginning in verse 1, through the next several verses where the writer says, set your mind on the things that are above, not on the things that are upon the earth. Put to death the things that are upon the earth, and put on, therefore, as God's elect. We see this contrast between good and evil, the righteous person and the wicked person. We need to be able to clearly identify who that is. And so we've got this in this chapter all summed up nice and tidy with a bow on top, so we can identify who the righteous person is and the wicked person. Now, as you know, when we get to the end of it, we're going to ask the question, which one represents you? Is that fair? Which one represents me? So, the question, Jehovah, who shall dwell in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy temple? So here we've got the question, and just simply asking the question, it ought to indicate that only certain people will be there. Which also helps us to understand there are certain folks that won't be there. I think that I almost said Drew. Darrell presented a lesson on hell in my absence. And when he did so, I would dare say he probably discussed, though I've not listened to it, who is going to hell. Would that be a fair assessment of his lesson?
He went the other direction. He talked about heaven.
All right, who's not going to hell? All right, well, see, I ought to listen to it for a comment on it. Yeah. Well, that kind of gives us a contrast similar to what we're looking at here. And it has some reality to it. So only certain people will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Psalm 61. Let's just look at these just a little bit and see that these become repetitive themes. Psalm 61, verse 4. I will dwell in thy in thy tabernacle forever. I will take refuge in the covert of thy wings. Here again, he's expressing confidence in God. Now, maybe more familiar to us would be text from the book of Revelation that we've studied in some recent history. In Revelation 21, in verse 3, I heard a great voice out of the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. I will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning or crying any more. The first things are passed away and so forth. Now what we learned in our study of Revelation 21, though some believe that this is an image simply of the church as it exists today, it's my judgment that this is an image of the church in its glorified state, that is, in heaven, the redeemed of the ages. And so what we want to note, you want to be in this group of people?
where there's no tears, there's no sorrow, no pain. You want to be in that group of people, or you want to be in that group of people where, like Abraham said, son, remember that thou in thy lifetime had good things and Lazarus in like manner evil things. Now here he is comforted and thou art in anguish. Now how long would you be called upon to remember that? Forever and ever, you see. So only certain folks are going to be privileged to go to heaven. And we noticed in our study of the book of Revelation in the 7th chapter and in verse 15, the writer says, therefore are they before the throne of God, and they shall serve him day and night in his temple. And he that sitteth on the throne shall spread his tabernacle over them. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more, neither shall the sun strike upon them, nor any heat. For the Lamb that is in the midst of the throne shall be their shepherd, and shall guide them unto fountains of waters of life, and God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. Sound very similar to Revelation 21, doesn't it? So he's describing the reward of those who are faithful. And you can follow other passages that are on the board if you like, but I think you see the point. Only certain ones are going to be privileged to be in the house of the Lord forever. So the question now begins to be answered. And I'm going to divide it just like we have it on the board. You'll notice that Psalm 15 is not very long. And basically two sections, the righteous and the wicked. They're described. And in verse 2, we see the righteous. The righteous walk uprightly, worketh righteousness, speaks the truth. And then again in verse 4, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honoreth them that fear Jehovah. He swears to his own hurt and changes not. He's faithful to his word. And then these other two verses, verse 3 and verse 5, give us the negative side of that. The person that is not going to be in God's house. Isn't that simple? That's just a real simple sermon. Juan, write that down. You may want to preach that sometime. Okay, simple sermon. Okay, let's look at these just carefully. The righteous person walks uprightly. Anyone who claims to abide in the Word of God ought to walk even as he walked. That becomes a theme that's repeated over and over, especially in the writing of John, in his epistles especially. And if you'll note in 1 John chapter 2, beginning in verse 3. Look at your Bible, 1 John chapter 2, verse 3. And hereby we know that we know him, if we keep his commandments. He that saith, I know him, and keepeth not his commandments, is a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whoso keepeth his word, in him verily hath the love of God been perfected. Hereby we know that we are in him. He that saith he abideth in him ought himself also to walk even as he walked. Now again, isn't that simple? That's what the psalmist states. Yes, back here. 1 John 2, beginning in verse 3 through verse 6. Well, sorry about that. 1 John 2, verse 3 through 6. Claire?
I find that where I live now, one of the hardest things to not get involved in is gossip.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so many people there.
Yeah.
And we get new people all the time. And I finally told one lady, I'm not going to participate in that. That's not right, and it just tears people down.
Yeah. Well.
But it's hard, you know, with all those people doing it all the time.
Well, that's one of the negative things that we see in verse 3.
Yeah.
He doesn't slander with his tongue.
Yeah.
The righteous man don't do that. And how much damage is done by the evil use of our tongue. Claire, let me tell you a story. There was a woman one time that she was a part of some kind of quilting club. And of course, the ladies got together and they'd make their quilts and they'd get to talking about what's going on in town. This one lady, she never said anything bad about anybody, not a word. And everything she had to say was complimentary. And the people noticed it. She never said anything bad about anybody. And they thought, that just can't be right. So we've got to get her involved in the community gossip.
And so they determined one day that they were going to talk about the devil. They were going to really rip up the devil, one side and down the other. Surely she'd have something bad to say about the devil. And when they started saying bad things about the devil, she just sat there. And finally they noticed that she wasn't going to say anything. They commented and said, "Don't you, surely you've got something bad you can say about the devil?" She said, "No. But he sure knows how to get his work done," she said. So if there's anything good to even say about the devil, she realized he works awful hard and he gets his job done. Lesson to be learned, isn't it? Lesson to be learned. And we're talking about the man that is described as a righteous person. He's the man that walks upright, even as the Lord walks. Now, how do you know how the Lord walks?
It tells us in the Bible.
Tells us in the Bible, that's right. The Apostle Peter said that we're to follow his example. And then he tells us what he did and what he didn't do. Okay? And so that becomes a good passage for us to learn. And of course the psalmist goes on to elaborate that walking upright means you walk in God's truth. Well, we'll come back, it looks like, to Psalms 15 and start there next time as we resume our study of the Psalms. Thank you so much for your kind attention, your input, your patience, and our study this morning.